Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer is Harriet Williamson. I'm Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. This morning, in this hour, this second hour of the show, our guest is Andre Codrescu. He is a writer, has produced 4 volumes of poetry, 4 of fiction, 4 of memoirs and travelogues, 8 volumes of essays, and 5 anthologies. His most recent is a collection of all of the writings that he has done over the years about his adopted hometown, New Orleans. It's entitled New Orleans, Mon Amour, and it's published by Algonquin Books. It is out there in the bookstores now. And I'm sure you will find all of his other books as well if you're interested in reading some of his writing. Certainly you should be familiar, if you listen to public radio, familiar with his voice. He's been doing commentaries on National Public Radio and All Things Considered for quite a few years. He's won many awards for his work, including the Pushcart Prize and the ACLU Freedom of Speech Award. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois for a symposium that is in conjunction with his donating to the U of I Library a large collection of material, most of that, I guess, in Romanian, books that he had that now he thought the U of I Slavic Library would be a good home for them. So he donated them to the library, and he's here for that. And we are also pleased that he could be here and spend a little time talking with us. Thank you for being here.
It's good to be here, David.
So how was Mardi Gras?
Well, Mardi Gras was terribly intentional this year. People in New Orleans tried to prove to themselves that they can have a good time despite the disaster all around them and the city lying in ruins around the French Quarter and uptown. And they tried to express some political sentiments as well. So there was quite a bit of satire and some pretty bitter sentiments at the address of FEMA, the president, Congress, and everyone else who allowed our city to be destroyed, because the storm only did some of the damage, but most of it was done by the floods, which were caused by the breach in the levees built by the federal government.
Yeah. Some people, I gather, in the run-up to Mardi Gras thought that maybe there shouldn't be one this year. And I guess other people said, no, actually, we think it's really important for as a symbolic gesture of our refusing to be swept away. A lot of people, and I think maybe you were one of those who felt that for people in New Orleans, it was actually important to do it.
It was important for us. It was therapy. It was the beginning of healing. And it is the only festival in New Orleans where people come together, black and white, and express all the arts in the city. And some of them are very old. It's a 500-year-old city, so it's had a long time to develop all sorts of talents and eccentricities. And that all happens at Mardi Gras, from the Zulus to the Rex to the Croix de Vieux Carré. And they're mostly satirical parades, so it was important to us. I mean, we can write enough editorials to the newspapers and complain to the media in sober voices, but when you have 100 people with watermarks on their bodies and hieroglyphs on their skin walking down the street, it makes a statement that it somehow is more powerful.
Yeah. I think I read a piece that you wrote. It was published in the Los Angeles Times about Mardi Gras, and I think it was late last month, and I think the very first line was something to the effect that outsiders, non-New Orleanians, don't really understand what Mardi Gras is all about.
They don't. Most people think Mardi Gras is a party on Bourbon Street where drunk college kids throw beads at each other. Well, it isn't.
It's not?
No, it's not. That's just very late aspect of Mardi Gras. It's an old festival. Comes from medieval Europe, and New Orleanians prepare all year for it. They have secret crews that meet. They have balls, societies that put on the Mardi Gras, which is not corporate sponsored, which is really an expression of the people in the city. And it begins around January 1st, and it ends on Mardi Gras Day. That's the climax. parades march 2 weeks before Mardi Gras. This year they could only march down one street that was undamaged, but they're usually the spirit seizes the entire city, and the roles are reversed. The mobs rule the streets, and the powerful are the subjects of satire. So it is something that we don't know in America. And the fact that it takes so long is also somewhat un-American, because it's there's a great deal of time spent in simple joy and laissez-faire. And partying is the last party town in America, but it isn't just about partying. It is about all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. They're hard to explain.
So you're now teaching. You're at Baton Rouge,
right?
Is that right? So were you actually in the city when the hurricane hit?
No, I was in Baton Rouge when the hurricane hit, and very quickly my house in Baton Rouge filled with refugees from New Orleans who were escaping the city in various ways. A lot of my friends came on a stolen, commandeered pirate Jefferson City school bus. And the people in general who got away from the city in those critical days were people who did not listen to the authorities, were people who seized initiative on their own. Anybody who listened to what their local government or the federal government or the state government was telling them ended up pretty bad.
Hmm. Well, is that because the government was saying it's going to be okay, just stay put?
Well, it's because they were promising things they couldn't deliver. For instance, buses, which were not available to take people out of the city. So anybody who could find the means to get out didn't certainly wait for the reassurances of the mayor or the governor or Michael Brown or George Bush.
Yeah. It seems that now in as people have thought about what happened and the government response, that there's plenty of room for finding blame on all levels of government, local, state, federal. And I'm not even sure what point there is in deciding who you're going to blame, but who do you blame?
Well, you can apportion blame to everyone, but the main blame falls on the federal government. They built the levees. The Army Corps of Engineers built the levees. The levees broke. They should fix them. It's as simple as that. They didn't protect the city. Now the city has to be re-envisioned along whole other lines. It's not the city that I knew and that I wrote about in New Orleans, Mon Amour, which is a collection of 20 years of writings from the city. And it's a portrait of a city that doesn't exist anymore. It's my own kinky personal monument to a place that's never going to be the same.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Andre Codrescu. He's poet, novelist, has done screenwriting. He's the author of a number of books. You will find them in the bookstore. His most recent collects all of the things that he's written about New Orleans over years. The subtitle, 20 Years of Writings from the City, New Orleans, Mon Amour, and it's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, so you can find it in the bookstore. He teaches English. He's a professor of English at, Louisiana State?
Yes, Louisiana State University.
At Baton Rouge.
Right.
And he's here visiting the campus. And questions, by the way, are welcome. I guess I didn't mention that at the beginning. If you'd like to talk with Andre Codrescu, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think the first time you visited New Orleans was in the early 1980s? Is that right?
Yeah, I went there to visit my friend Philip Herder, an artist, a writer who was living there. And it was around Mardi Gras. And I fell in love with the city like many other people do. There is an entire category of folks called people who never left, who come for some kind of festival, for Jazz Fest or for Mardi Gras, and they leave husbands and children back in wherever they came from, and they stay. And these people who never left form the last bohemia left in America because, it was, even before the storm, was getting to be less of a bohemia because the real estate was very expensive. It was hard to find a cheap apartment. And to have a bohemia and to have a thriving artistic scene, you need cheap rent. So I fell violently in love with it and stayed.
I think one of the pieces in the book, you write something like, people who live in other places have a hard time understanding just what New Orleans means to people who live, you know, something. That's an exciting exact quote, but essentially, it's,
you know, what it means to miss New Orleans.
Yes, exactly. You know, other people really don't quite understand what New Orleans means to Orleanians. I hear and read the things that you say and have heard other people talk about the city, and I have to say I've not been there, so I have no personal experience. What is it about this place that for some people it just seems to grab them so much that, yeah, you know, there's no going back to Kansas or, you know, wherever it is that you were from before?
Well, New Orleans is New Orleans for whatever reason, but it means a lot of America as well. New Orleans is our most important cultural treasure as far as cities go, because that's where American music comes from. That's where jazz comes from, and that's where a variety of musics elaborated over time come from. This is the music that was the solace and soul balm for the slaves and for people, for the disadvantaged and the poor. So that comes from New Orleans. New Orleans is at the mouth of the Mississippi River, where it flows into the Gulf of Mexico. So it is where sugar, rum, and slaves were sold in the 19th century before the Civil War. It's our most important port. Is the city from where America became an empire. So a lot of our history is tied into New Orleans. So New Orleans has history, it has architecture, it has music, and it has the only native cuisine in America. So for all those reasons, New Orleans is important to more than just New Orleanians.
Yeah. It strikes me, and I don't know if this is true or not, that it may be of American major cities, one of the places that throughout its history might actually have changed the least. And I'm sure there are a lot of ways in which San Francisco is what it's always been, and New York has been what it's always been, and Chicago is been what it's always been, but that maybe that New Orleans is more what it's always been than some other places.
Well, maybe, but the storm ripped the roof right off the extreme poverty of New Orleans, and it's a kind of poverty that doesn't exist in Bush's America because it is hidden. The cities, if they didn't manage to hide it, they managed to somehow evaporate it, but not by making the people, giving the people better jobs and better housing, but somehow not talking about them. And New Orleans had a great many poor people at the same time that it was developing, like most American cities, and having a real estate boom. And so when the storm came, we saw the faces of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who lived in pretty miserable conditions. And people around the world who saw this couldn't believe this was happening in America. And now we saw it. And, you know, hopefully people put together a number of ideas like, well, if we can't do it in New Orleans, how can we do it in Iraq?
Let's talk with someone who's listening. We have a caller here in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I wish you'd be more forward in promoting your books, perhaps reading certain particulars out of a book, an excerpt would stimulate some of us to go out. But New Orleans, I would think more of the housing will have to be held in common now, perhaps condominium style, so that more land can be freed up.
Well, that is a very complicated issue, and what is going to happen to the neighborhoods in New Orleans that were destroyed by the floods is still in the hands of the Army Corps of Engineers that has yet to release its maps, and it's still being decided at various levels, but I think that most of the commercial interests, the serious interests in New Orleans, would like to make a smaller city and turn a lot of the poor neighborhoods into floodplain or wetland.
Certainly the lowlands will be declared floodplains, wouldn't you think?
I think so, and because of that, I think we should not tear down the levees, not build any more levees, and make New Orleans a water city, just like it was always meant to be a city, because we live in water, and people should be able to live on Lake Pontchartrain, on the Mississippi River, and live with the water instead of trying to turn away from it and fight it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions and comments are welcome if you'd like to talk with our guest, Andrei Codrescu. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And his books are available in a bookstore near you, so if you want to go down there, you can look for it, including his most recent, New Orleans, Mon Amour. Would you like to read something from the book?
Well, let me read this piece, From the Heart of the Storm. It's called... It's a letter to America, really. It's after the deluge. There will be a little bit of New Orleans everywhere when our refugees move into your communities. Here are some of the changes. Your food will get better. In the past 10 years, thanks to Asian and Latin flavors brought in by immigrants, American food improved. Now it will reach sublimity. Instead of canned music, you'll have the real live thing. Clubs will mushroom and street performers will make your town a livelier place. Start working now to remove the tight-ass rules that forbid street theater. Get ready to hear strangers open up to you in public places and tell you stories. You'll remember that once upon a time, before television, people used to say hello to strangers and tell them stories. There will be new coffee houses, bars, and community centers where you will hopefully forget to be a couch potato. Sure, you might become a barfly instead. But I'll take a human living drunk over a phony electronic pixel vampire. Many people will shoot their televisions. That's inevitable. And I will read the end of this, which is, you will be renewed by the intelligence of a whole culture, just the way we were renewed by the refugees of Europe after Second World War. On the downside, you will start smoking again.
You will start smoking again. Andrei Codrescu, could not be anybody else. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Smoke them if you got them. Let's talk with someone else here again on the phone, and that's Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm concerned about what the new Orleans will look like in terms of its demographics, specifically its racial and socioeconomic demographics. I recall a Republican legislator in Congress out of Baton Rouge who made the comment. He tried to back away from it, I think, the next day when it stirred controversy, that Hurricane Katrina had eliminated public housing in New Orleans, and God did something that we couldn't do. As an African American, and I've talked to other intellectual African Americans who view New Orleans as perhaps the new Las Vegas of the South, very lean, mean, and white. And I read an article in the New York Times recently that said as many as 80% of African American denizens of New Orleans may not return. So, what are your views about that issue, or those issues?
Well, you are absolutely right to worry. It is true that 80% of African Americans are not in the city, that there are people who are planning to have a smaller white majority city, and it would be great if there was a focus to the idea of bringing people back, and that means all the people who left New Orleans. The people are New Orleans. They're the culture of New Orleans. And any kind of building plan, there is a plan called Bring Back New Orleans. If you notice, it's called Bring Back New Orleans, not Bring Back the People of New Orleans. If that plan succeeds and certainly has a lot of money and big-time developers behind it, it will be Las Vegas, Disney, reinvention, and it is a civil rights issue, but exactly how it should be framed, it is very difficult to say.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other people who are listening, you want to give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I know in some of the things that I have read you talking about in New Orleans, you say the city has a gender. The cover of the book is a sort of a blurry photograph, obviously, of a woman's face. New Orleans is feminine?
For me, it is. Yeah, for me, it is. It's a city of the night. It's a city of the river. It's a city, it's a tropical or semi-tropical city where people take a siesta in the afternoon and they live at night. Most of the music clubs get kicking around midnight, and it has a living night, unlike most of America, where people go to bed after the 10 o'clock news.
Mm. Sounds interesting, although I'm not sure I could cope with the humidity. That's something about the climate and me.
It's an acquired taste. We have New Orleans School for the Imagination, where we teach sweat management.
Sounds like, can you do an advanced degree in that?
Yeah, we do, actually. The advanced includes learning how to sweat so that every drop goes to where you want it to, not just falling indiscriminately.
That must be a great skill. It must take a lot of practice.
It does. That's what we teach it. It's like modern dance.
It's been interesting to hear you. You've been on All Things Considered this week when the ATC crew was down there. It was really interesting. I heard you and your son last night. Amazingly enough, you have a 25-year-old son. I don't know. Does that amaze you that you have a 25-year-old son?
Oh, it amazes me, and he's a lot smarter than I am. Devilishly articulate. He grew up in New Orleans. He's an actor and a future student of Chinese medicine. He just came back with his girlfriend from Brazil and Peru, where they studied various shamanic practices.
How does that? I get. Here's another experience that not being a parent, I've never had. How does that feel when you know that this person somehow has to be genetically related to you, and yet clearly they're their own person, and who would never have thought that he? I'm sure you would probably have not thought he would go off in these, or maybe you did think he would go off in those various directions.
Well, I feel a great sense of relief. I also like him, so that works out.
Well, that's helpful.
Right.
That's helpful. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580, talking with writer Andrei Codrescu. He's here for a symposium in connection with his donating to the University of Illinois Library a large collection of material, a lot of it in Romanian that he had managed to accumulate over the years, and thought that the Slavic Languages Library here would be a good place for it. And so now we have the Codrescu collection here. And he's here for that and was good enough to come and spend some time talking with us. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. People may or may not know, I expect that you were born in Romania.
Transylvania.
In Transylvania. And came here in the mid-60s? Are there some things, some ways in which, I guess I'm going back to this idea of what about New Orleans really grabbed you? Some ways in which New Orleans is like the place that you grew up, or the places that you grew up?
Well, I came in 1966 with my mother to Detroit, Michigan, and experienced really the tail end of a very nasty winter in the Midwest. I moved to New York in 1968 to find the poets and the writers. America in the mid-60s was in crisis. The young were fighting the old. The war in Vietnam was going on. The counterculture was making its own claims for the kind of worlds that we wanted to see. And so there was a great deal of upheaval. And then after the mid-70s, this country took a different kind of turn. And everybody more or less took their place on the treadmill and the machinery of what it is to have a great productive country and very little time for yourself. In New Orleans, I found something that I knew in my childhood in Romania, which is time for dreaming. New Orleans somehow affords you that if you can take it or know how to do it. In some way. And then in other ways, too, because it's a pedestrian city. It was built before cars. And cars don't rule the streets. People do. And they're still on the street. The street is alive. There are coffee houses. There are people talking to each other. There are neighbors on the stoop telling each other all sorts of things. People at bus stops tell you stories.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else. Let's see. Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Did Katrina affect the Cajuns or the Bayous? Does anyone know or care?
Well, of course it did. All of southern Louisiana was affected, and there were some Cajun communities that were affected. They lost their livelihood because many of them were fishermen. Vermilion Parish got it pretty bad. It's part of the same the same disaster, but some of the Cajun communities are built for living on water, and so the houses, the houseboats, pontoons, fishing camps, they did better in the storm than the slab houses of New Orleans.
Are they farther away from the barriers that didn't hold up?
Oh, yeah, their communities are really much more directly in the water, and they don't depend for their protection on levees.
Well, they must be farther from the city then.
Oh, yeah.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, they're more like they ride on the water.
They ride on the water.
It's not like they're holding it back.
I met a guy who went to visit his parents on the bayou, and he said it's just hard finding them because their house keeps moving. The postman's never been there twice.
Let's talk again with another caller here, Champagne. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just was wondering, I know after 9/11, a lot of people's faith was questioned, and some it supported their own faith and enriched their faith, and some abandon their faith completely. I was wondering if you happen to have any idea what the religious community down there is like now after the tragedy and the devastation. Are people still very religious, or are they're kind of questioning their own faith?
Well, I'm not sure which religious people I might think of, but certainly New Orleans is a Catholic city, and people did pray and go to their churches, and they have saints that are supposed to protect the city, and one statue of the Virgin is purported to have protected the city in past calamities during war or yellow fever or floods. She just was asleep this time. But I suppose that people who have faith will probably do okay, because they will get right back to work, and they will think that the divine plan is working. I think it would be an aid in this kind of situation.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions, other comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Some religious leaders who shall remain nameless engage in a lot of finger wagging after this and say, well, you know, New Orleans, you know what kind of a place it is. It's pretty decadent. It's a flesh pot. This is the wrath. Finally, sooner or later, it happens. The wrath of God visited on this wicked Sodom and Gomorrah. You know the story.
If that's the case, I don't see why the French Quarter was left intact, because that's where all the sins go on. The Sodom and Gomorrah is in the French Quarter. And the French Quarter was unscathed by the storm. So these people are just talking to make themselves heard and get their basket filled with money by their parishioners.
Was there any, as you've said, and I think a lot of people have said, this was really not a natural disaster. This was a human-caused disaster.
Absolutely.
It was not, the hit of the storm, the city weathered the hit of the storm. If the levees hadn't have broken, the city got flooded, we wouldn't be where we are. No.
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers, the federal government, put those levees in badly. The levees didn't hold. It's their responsibility. Yeah. It was a man-made catastrophe.
Is there any? Do people have any sense that somehow, though, that they were not? They kind of took their eye off the ball. That there was too much warning. There were too many people who said, you know, one of these days, and that somehow maybe if people in the city had, I don't know what, had done something different, maybe that this would not have happened.
Well, there were a lot of stupid things that the city did, like park the buses where they couldn't be had for evacuation. But that is a small kind of stupidity compared to the fact that our government is supposed to be prepared for an emergency of this kind. And in fact, they had an exercise that told them exactly what was going to happen in the event of a storm. And now it turns out that the president knew as the storm was approaching. So all of those excuses don't hold. The government failed miserably, and it's part of the inattention of this administration to our real problems. These are people who are so preoccupied by Iraq that they are ignoring our country. And it became clear when the head of FEMA wouldn't even call his boss at Homeland Security, and his boss at Homeland Security wouldn't talk to the president about an American city going under. If it had been a terrorist attack, you'd bet we'd have attacked about 10 countries by now.
Mattoon. Let's talk with a caller here in Mattoon, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just got a couple of comments. I know the U.S. government, the taxpayers, and FEMA, we are throwing loads and loads of money down there, and all we get is hindsight in 2020, and we get people talking about things that should have been done and could have been done, and I'm just not interested in continuing what we're doing here. And there's a lot to America other than just New Orleans. You know, you can look around and good things are happening everywhere, and I'm just getting, I've just kind of heard enough of that.
Well, that's because what you hear is from the media, and the media is not presenting the true picture of the disaster. New Orleans is extremely important, and the fact that FEMA and the government is throwing money, it just shows how incompetent they are at throwing money at problems instead of actually solving them intelligently. You know, FEMA spent about $200 million on trailers that are sitting over there in Arkansas unused while people need housing. Now, whose problem is that but the huge bureaucracy? Well, they could have bought everybody a condo in the French Quarter by now and the car.
I realize that there's a lot of that going on, that there's trailers sitting. I mean, I live by the interstate, and you cannot look out in not 10 minutes to see a trailer go by. And I just think there's always finger-pointing. There's always, you know, I mean, what are... Are they taking care of themselves down there, or are they just waiting for somebody to do something for them? I mean...
Well, you know, the people took care of themselves in the catastrophe, in the storm, because the government wasn't there for 5 days. There are people drowning in the water. There are 2,000 dead people in New Orleans. People made self-help efforts to get boats and anything that floats. There was rescue going on all the time, just rescue by civilians, way before the National Guard showed up or anybody from the government.
Are the people taking responsibility for themselves now? Are they working hard? Are they creating jobs? Are they doing something other than complaining now?
Nobody's complaining.
Are they actively going out and working now?
Of course they are. Nobody's complaining. You know, most of the citizens of New Orleans are not in New Orleans because they are not being allowed to come back. So, yeah, there are people working there, but there are contractors and there are all kinds of people from outside who have come in because there is money to be made, and it's a good thing they've come. But you have to imagine a ruined city. It's very hard for people to grasp the fact that this looks like Dresden looked after the bombing in World War II, that you don't get from television the idea that 80% of the buildings in the city are destroyed. People don't have homes.
Do we need to go back and rebuild this thing again? And do we need to build like it was?
No, we need to build it smartly. We don't need to build it like it was. It was bad the way it was. It was in a floodplain, and it shouldn't have been allowed to be done that way in the first place.
Well, one of these days, the last news truck's going to leave, and I hope it's all taken care of before the last news truck leaves.
Well, it won't. You know, America has a phoenix complex, you know. It's got to rise from the ashes in 48 minutes minus commercials.
Okay, well, I want to let you know that I disagree with a lot of the things I'm seeing and hearing, but
well, thanks.
I appreciate your feeling for a city. I just wish you felt that way. I could go around and see the rest of the United States.
Thank you. Thanks for your opinion. But, you know, I'm a big lover of cities. I've been everywhere in this country, and I love the country, too. And I spend as much time as I can in the country outside the cities. So, you know, it isn't, you know, I don't think that our problem is detrimental to other cities. Is, if anything, a lesson in what could happen anywhere. Mm.
Having been close to what was really going on, or at least being able to talk with a lot of people who had come from the city or had opportunity to see that, and then seeing the kind of coverage that national media was giving, how good a job do you think that the media was doing at actually reporting the story? And if you were there or if you were closer, would you have a very different kind of perception than if you were here, for example, in Champaign-Urbana, just watching this on CNN?
Well, CNN and NPR did a very good job. I would say that of the two networks, of the many networks, CNN, especially Anderson Cooper and NPR, did a good job of staying on the story, but they can't cover it in its magnitude. It's a big story, and you need a reporter almost, you know, on every street corner to know what's going on. So there is a disconnect between what we're seeing on television and what is going on in the city. This disconnect was evident even to us in Baton Rouge. My house was full of refugees from New Orleans. People kept coming out of New Orleans to stay with me until I had to run away from the refugees. I refugiated myself from the refugees. But people were coming in, and their stories were not jibing with what they were seeing on CNN. We had the televisions on. The telephone was ringing all the time. The emails never stopped coming. People, it was just a constant matrix of stories. Buzzing around Baton Rouge, and still we couldn't really grasp what was going on. I went into the city 3 days after the storm, and the impression was absolutely powerful, and it wasn't like anything I was seeing on TV or even anything I was hearing from my friends.
Yeah, and it was just the scope of the destruction just wasn't it's not as if what you said to the caller was that the only way you could really know what it's like is if you could go there and stand there and look around and see it.
You can do it now. The Gray Line is conducting tours through the Lower Ninth Ward and Lakeview.
Are tourists touring the disaster?
Ghoulish tours. But in a way, it's about the only way to see it. When you see a fishing boat in a house three miles from where it was originally, you get some idea. And the roofs on the ground, the house is buried completely underneath. There are still bodies there. They're still finding bodies.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left. Andre Kudrescu is our guest. He's a professor of English at Louisiana State University, Baton Rouge, NPR commentator, novelist, poet. And we have some other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Yes, Andrew. Andrew, I appreciate the opportunity to hear from you. Always enjoy your shows and your comments. And I grew up in western Illinois and lived through a couple of major floods we've had over the last 30 years there. Sometimes we moved whole cities in response to them. Sometimes we reinforced levees. Sometimes we created parks out of the worst flooded areas. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on what you think is going to be the way of rebuilding the city, what might be appropriate there. Thank you. I'll hang up.
My own feeling is that we should start living with the water and building, if not houseboats, then some kind of amphibian developments that will withstand water surges and can live with the water. Some of it will have to be returned to wetlands, which makes a natural barrier between the Gulf of Mexico and New Orleans, and park. And there will have to be a variety of solutions but there is no question of moving the city because this is our second oldest city, and we need its culture and we need its people. There are a great many discussions going on now. And obviously money talks the loudest, and I would say that the Bring Back New Orleans plan, which is backed by Joe Canizero, a very big developer in New Orleans and a big contributor to the campaign of George Bush, is probably going to prevail, despite our best hopes for a green city, a wireless connected city, and a wonderful reborn New Orleans.
Mm. Let's talk with next someone in Champaign, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Uh-huh.
I was compelled to call because the caller a little while ago who was upset about your speaking to the problem of this current administration and its handling of the crisis and Katrina and so on. I find this actually quite incredible, and I'm wondering, you know, just a few years ago, I remember reading in the New York Times, I think there was a New York Times magazine article about the fact that there was this impending possible catastrophe in New Orleans. And they said at the time that 100,000 people could die. And I was telling my friends this at the time. I said, this is incredible because I love New Orleans. I go to, you know, to major conferences there and so on. And so it was just this terrible thing that I kind of sensed was going to happen at some point. And but the thing that I find so amazing is this earlier caller, when you call a spade in a sense, a federal government that, in the case of hurricanes in Florida, terrible hurricanes, was competent, responded, did what was necessary, certainly not perfectly, but through the course of the 1990s, did things that were necessary to fix the problem. Whereas in the case of Katrina, you have an administration which has intentionally privatized on a level that's, handed to basically to the states responsibilities and so on that states are incapable of handling. And I'm amazed at the ideological backlash toward those who would suggest that George Bush lied when he said 4 days after the event that he'd never been told the levees could break. And now we know and we have factual evidence. And I guarantee you there will be no investigation of this because of the houses of Congress being controlled by Republicans. So I congratulate you for speaking directly to this, and I wish you would speak more about this as well as others as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You are right. We are a democratic city that displays all of the qualities and defects that this Republican administration would like to disappear somehow. So, hence the lack of help. Florida, of course, was the state that made George Bush president, so they got more attention. But they didn't get. There's still people living in trailers in Florida, so it wasn't that great a job. When it happens next, somewhere, maybe in San Francisco, we'll see how prepared they are.
Next, we'll talk with someone, I believe, in Champaign County. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, the last caller sort of evoked the rage that I was feeling, so maybe I'll try and be dispassionate despite the fact that it isn't what I really want to do. But I think there may be some people thinking that, you know, your idea of living with the water is sort of fanciful, but in the water floodplains of St. Lawrence and in the Netherlands, which everyone points at because 70% of it is under sea level, they have these structures that rise and lower with the water, and they're sort of moored boats that people live in. So there are options of that. But looking at the Netherlands as an example, it just seems to me that one thing I heard from ex-New Orleans, although he comes back quite often, Harry Shearer, who's watching it quite closely, is that and I've seen this written too, so it isn't just a humorist, satirist point of view on things, but obviously the devastation was quite widespread, and not everything can be summed up in one thing, but a lot of the flooding that happened right in the urban center of New Orleans and the North Ward, the Ninth Ward particularly, didn't come from the Mississippi River or Lake Pontchartrain directly. It came from these industrial canals, which, you know, a technician from the Netherlands would look at this and say, this was eminently easy to prevent the canals from flooding this area. I mean, you just have right. A way of blocking off the canal, and that makes it absolutely surreal that, you know, it wasn't even the big one. It was a Category 3 by the time it hit. It was a huge one, which is probably global warming related, but it could have been. It didn't have to happen this way. There would have been devastation, but the flooding didn't have to happen right. The way they did. I'm getting apoplectic here.
No, it's fine. No, Harry's totally right. The first order of business is to close Mr. Go, which is the Mississippi Lake Canal, which is used by the shipping interests, but that is going to be closed. But you're right, it's bad engineering all around, and great destruction of wetlands for the past 30 years because of industrial activity, because of oil companies and chemical companies' interests in drilling and shipping. So we lose, before the storm, we are losing hundreds of square miles of wetlands every day.
Yeah. And it's not that would have prevented the kind of damage, but again, I think people say, well, that's supposed to be a buffer.
But those are barriers, right? And yeah. The levees were built by the Army Corps, yeah. So the caller is right. We We have to learn how to live more smartly and engineer more smartly. And the Netherlands is a very good example. We're definitely studying that.
Kankakee is next, line four. Hello.
Andrei Kudescu. Welcome to Illinois.
Thank you.
Your caller wonders what are your thoughts on some visionary designs for a new New Orleans, perhaps a la Paulo Soleri megastructure, and what do you think of a new urbanism as applied to a new New Orleans or the next New Orleans? And what more have you to say about the mouth of the Mississippi wetlands? Thank you.
Well, I'm deadly afraid of new urbanism because I grew up in communist Romania, and big projects scare me. I like cities that develop organically over time and decay and wrap themselves around the needs of the people rather than big plants to start with. But obviously, we have to have a bigger vision here, and one of them would be to make the entire city of New Orleans a free port, like Hong Kong used to be, or the island of Crimea and the Vasily Aksionov novel, The Island of Crimea, a place where there are no duties, no taxes. Any artist that wants to settle there should be able to settle there and work there and declare some of the destroyed parts of the city monumental historical parks, and most of all, bring the people back and make the city denser, bring everybody back who wants to come back, and have them live with in the French Quarter and uptown, the areas that haven't flooded. So, you know, my vision of the city is one of intense anarchism, poetic, artistic anarchism aided by free, no duties and tax-free creativity.
And what do you think is really going to happen?
What's really going to happen is that Joe Canizero and his boys are going to put up some Miami-style tall buildings and create this sort of mallish type communities that will be centered around box stores, chain box stores, and just casinos. And I believe that we should legalize everything there. We should legalize gambling, which we have legalized, but on a bigger scale, prostitution, drugs, everything that Freeport might thrive on.
Okay. We'll take that under advisement. Let's go next to another caller. Windsor, line three, I believe. Hello.
Hello. I have two comments. One is, sir, this is 2006, and the other is, tell me how George Bush caused a hurricane. I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
George Bush didn't cause the hurricane. He just wasn't ready for the disaster, which he promised us he would be ready, and the government would be ready, and the Homeland Security would be ready for anything that would happen to our citizens on a mass scale. And when it came right down to it, it turned out that these guys didn't know what they were doing.
Is there any sense at all that you're maybe just a little bit annoyed that there would be some people, Democrats, who would actually use this as, you know, the proverbial big stick to whack the president? Do you feel used at all by anybody?
No, I don't feel used, because there's absolutely nothing you can do to the president who's still got 3 years in office, and the issue is not one of partisan politics. The issue is one of preparedness and helping the citizenry. And the issue is also that we do not have a visionary leader in place who can envision some sort of big change, like Roosevelt did in the New Deal, or someone who could actually think beyond the immediate politics of the moment. I think this administration doesn't think beyond the next press briefing.
So you're not planning on going anywhere yourself, right? You're going to stay where you are?
Well, I'm going to stay where I am and help where I can.
Yeah. And do you expect that you continue to live in Louisiana, or do you have some sort of impulse possibly to, or do you think that there could be some other place that you just might happen to go that would you'd find as attractive and as interesting as New Orleans and environs?
Well, I love the city of New Orleans, but, you know, I may be the devil, and so, you know, maybe the catastrophes are my fault.
That's an entertaining theory.
Maybe if I move somewhere else, something dreadful will happen. You know, I seem to be a sort of a specialist in historic catastrophe.
Well, in that case, the city fathers would keep an eye out for you, and if you approach the city limits, they'd say, sorry, Mr. Kudrescu,
we
don't like your kind around here. Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. Andrei Kudrescu, he has written 4 volumes of poetry, 4 of fiction, 4 of memoirs, travelogues, 8 volumes of essays, 5 anthologies. He does commentary regularly on All Things Considered on NPR. He teaches English at Louisiana State University at Baton Rouge. His most recent book is a collection of all of the things that he's written about New Orleans over the years, New Orleans Mon Amour. It's published by the Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And he's here for a symposium that's connected to his donating to the U of I library a large collection of material, most of it in Romanian, that he accumulated over the years and thought Slavic languages and literature here would be a good home. So here it is, and here he is. And again, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.